French accent is as bad as mine, Kieran.
Shocking your voice.
It's lovely to be here, and I want to thank Paul. I know he's not here, but I think the world will be better where he is than he is here. And I'm looking forward to hearing Sarah read as well. So, yeah, the Abroad Writers Conference, there's a list there of all the people that are doing workshops and reading as well. And there's so many festivals and events around. There was the Cork Midsummer Festival this last week or so. And then in Kinsale, there's one on the 7th, 8th, and 9th of July. Where's Max Cleave? And she's playing. And one or two readers are around town. And then there's the Word on Water in October. So if anybody fancies dressing up, there's a Jane Austen ball there at Ballinacura House. So, you're reading, aren't you, Max? Not tonight. I mean, are you playing music in Kinsale on the 7th?
God, I know I was playing
to the microphone. So, yeah. Okay, you are. So, can you tell? I'm leading into the Kinsale poem. So, homage to Kinsale. As night's obsidian curtain lifted, the skylark heralds the dawn chorus in mighty measure of duckhead blue. From my balcony, a mirage of matchstick masts navigate the thirsty mouth of the harbour, and my skin drinks it all in. Sometimes when I bury myself in myself, never quite reaching the point when thinking stops, I unlatch the door, drink tea, and save a wildberry tart at Poet's Corner, or stroll to the Spaniard where the swans dance to Francesca's mandolin. And in my solitude, I feel quietly content. I look at life in black and white at the gallery, buy a chiffon scarf from Stone Mad, peacock feathers with hand-stitched beads, and fly it like a kite on the beach. After sundown, you'll find me in the Black Pig, sipping a glass of red, satisfied with the feeling that finally I have arrived. Looking say both great, and there's such a creative vibe down there. There's these tall ships, I was just saying that tall ships come in from time to time, but unfortunately I keep missing them. They're lovely to see. The second poem is, well, as anybody knows, I'm a lover of classical music as well. And this was inspired by a CD of Ivan Illich playing Morton Feldman. Well, Morton Feldman is a contemporary American composer. He played piano, and he really experimented, so he broke the boundaries of convention. And it was just listening to the way that the notes are spaced out. They're very unpredictable. So it was hearing the notes and hearing them resonate, and also thinking that some people have synesthesia, where they hear notes and they see colour. So it was kind of all that that inspired this poem. And thinking about a note as well, that when you read it on a manuscript, it's in the bars, in the stave, trapped. So the feeling that this note has become free and it can anything go anywhere. So it's from a series in the Absence of Boundaries called The Third Movement. A note from the other side of silence hangs in mid-air blue, undefined, intangible, uncharted, neither lengthening nor shortening, or pulled by gravity's umbilical cord. I wonder if the wind will carry it in her wings, perhaps into another realm. Is it transcending, tentatively balanced on the sacred, votive, perhaps coiling around a prayer wheel or roaming the streets of Manhattan to dance with Ksenia in various shades of black and white? It has no place for concealment, no obstacle to circumvent. Is it an apparition on center stage with no curator? A muted tone on a Chagall, lowering its pitch to a finely tuned line of cerulean blue? Or does it linger in an atelier in Antibes, where, Ascending from a counterpoint, it improvises with the light. It does not hide in the mouth of frescoes, lined with cardinal red, where it cannot speak of freedom, or in the narrow place where it cannot stretch and where the light does not enter. Sometimes it weighs as heavy as a Caravaggio, a magnum opus as dark as a requiem's crown of thorns, a dying cadence longing to flee from a penitentiary stave, to lightly play between the shadow and the shadowless in your visionary third eye, the eye between eyes, where those who listen see, and those who see listen. Thank you. So, yeah, I keep going to Paris. I'm in love with Paris. I kind of felt home from home because I don't know if anybody's been to the spoken word. No? Yes? Yes? It's like every Monday night. And instead of coming up here to the hayloft here, they go down into the basement. Is it Au Chat Noir or Le Chat Noir? So it's in a pub. Maybe it's moved by freaks since you were there. Maybe it's moved by new.
It was in
Au Chat Noir. So that's kind of home from home. And I even went for tea at the Ritz. And got served by a girl from Middleton.
Can't escape it.
No, and in the same hotel, there were some people from Cork.
Yes.
It was fantastic, really. So, yeah, I love Paris. And to think that you're walking in the footsteps of like Ernest Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, Picasso, it's just incredible. And of course, Paris in those days, in the 20s, was very different because like Montmartre was vineyards and goats. So it had a totally different feel in those days, but it was just a magnet for all the artists and writers. So this is from a series, The Paris Sketchbook, Pastiche. Paris opened as a book under my skin. A movable feast, Hemingway once said. There is no war under my skin, only art that sometimes speaks of war. In Eglise, Saint-Julien-le-Pauvre, the first six notes of Bach's Marcello Adagio chime with Notre Dame. A note cannot play without the air, and the air was filled with hibiscus. Paris is a panacea, my alter ego blossoming as sweet as spring on Sunday's stroll in Jardin de Luxembourg with Antonia, along the Seine, unblemished bathers in July's La Plage, promenade next to drowsy heat of the afternoon right and left bank booksellers and posters of Le Chat Noir, Pont Neuf, a synapse lay between. I watched the way the light fell, and I fell into myself, and it felt good, and it felt strong. I watched sober shadows from second-story windows at La Palette, etched into lithographs at Musée d'Orsay, in the same room as Mademoiselle Chanel's nonchalant eyes, half sleeping, half remembering the protagonists at Rue de Seine, more than a generation ago. I wandered into antiquity, a milieu of veined alleyways leaning into the bow of Ile Saint-Louis. I searched for lost time, à la recherche du temps perdu, with Proust and Jean-Paul Sartre. Unconscious Belle Époque minds unleashed, along with espressos and Coco Van at Café de Flore. I turned away from the rifled gendarmes and unrest, opened my book, and began to sketch. The art of seeing. There is a place I sit and sketch the still shade before the light fades in and out of restless dusk, There is a place where broken shadows rendezvous with La Bohème and Chopin's Etude in C minor. Falling as arpeggios, weightless snow weighed heavily on cold bones of Paris. Impermanence melted white on soundless white, audible only at the edge of silence. At Place de la Concorde, Cleopatra's needle stitches clouds. An easterly wind severs flesh and pleached limes. Paper-thin leaves shudder into chaos to bind winter wounds the colour of blood. I sketch in grey graphite, the colour of stone, feel the chill of a revolution in my bones. At Notre Dame, gnarled gargoyles gather rain and Gregorian chants. Understand and misunderstand the things that were, things that are, and l'avenir, things to come. It is cold at Père Lachaise as I watch the City of Light tremble, and I wonder, would we see more clearly in the dark? Emotional because obviously there was heavy security everywhere when I was there. There was some incidents happened, so yeah. One of the places I love was the Museed Orangery, where there's mummies, water lilies, and he actually was involved in the designing of the room. So it's just like you feel like you're underground actually. Beautiful, kind of a calm space. If you've been, you know. And so one of a friend of mine actually on Facebook was playing there. They have concerts there, so they wheel in the Steinway, and to think that it's just beautiful. And she was playing Debussy, and one of Debussy's contemporaries was Degas. So this really is kind of thinking about Degas, Debussy, the Musée d'Orangerie, and Degas. He actually didn't sell some of his paintings for some time because his family were wealthy, but it's when his father died, his brother left a lot of debt, so he sold them, but he was so meticulous, he actually bought them back because he was never satisfied with them. The thing is, you can't do that because when a poem is published, it's that's it, it's done. But he kept buying them back. And you know, I always say to people, find your passion, follow your passion. And I didn't realise the root of the word passion is patra, and it means to suffer. It means to suffer. So, yeah. So I was thinking how Debussy suffered, and actually thinking about the avant-garde there, even Matisse, he did a painting, The Woman in a Hat. And you know, the Salon, they accepted the academic artists. Then the avant-garde had the alternative salons. And the lady in the hat went in the alternative salon, and people hated it that much. They scratched the paint off it. But it was eventually sold to Gertrude Stein. So, you know, passion, suffer. We suffer for our art, whatever music, and our passion. And I know I suffer when I write, so I'm suffering now. Through the eyes of an artist. December, and one hand lifts the windswept air from houseman rooftops, and Henry Moore's reclining nude, an acquisition in bronze. The other hand measures perspective, and dépasse la neige, footprints in the snow, before rolling oil pastels between thumb and forefinger the same way as Gitane's. Degas tells us about the art of painting, how to search for lost colour and hue in the shadows, elusive to all but the discerning eye. How shafts of light softly fall into the chiffon skirt of a dancer, her limbs outstretched like the statue of a Hindu god, time curving her spine to wounded satin feet. how at Rue de Laval a mirror leans into an arabesque. A double bass lies layered with dust, cerise, mauve and lemon. And how he performs a pas de deux with illusion and reality, his studio rancorous with failing sight, solitude rehearsing in the wings. Poised next to a Delacroix, an aspiring Le Petit Danseur, the little dancer, where at Palais Garnier pouring hot wax he sculpts movement, coquettish pink limbs lighter than air, flirt with frozen whitewashed walls and the avant-garde. In the corner of the room, a violin is waiting to be tuned next to an unfinished canvas. Spring grows with the scent of the first orange blossoms, but until then, winter presses silhouettes against window panes, as unyielding and potent as undiluted red wine before snow. At Musée de l'Orangerie, the ghost of October's black piano still lingers, the wind and Debussy fading with the frame petals of a water lily. So the undiluted red wine before snow actually is, the Greeks used to dilute the wine with snow, which I found hard to believe at first, because you think of Greece, everybody's sombre and it's really hot, but they did, they would dilute their wine with snow. And Debussy, of course, he lost his eyesight, so that's when he sculpted his little dancers, you may know. She's like that. She was sculpted in wax, and then she's in bronze, and she's in the Louvre. So it's just, you know, kind of, he suffered with his eyesight there. And the last poem, then, is one back to Ireland, but it has a French connection, because this is one that was read by Ryan Rim, and he studied at the Gaiety Theatre and he works for Irish Celt, so it was read in 59 Rivoli, which is Rue de Rivoli, which is in Paris, and it was read in Lyon and another village in the Alps, and he played it, he read it as he played a Fauron. So a Celtic legacy. Rising from Celtic mists, calloused white bone fingers on goat skin, unravel lyrical etchings on ancient stone that weeps beneath wounds swathed in redolent moss and pink vein thrift. Stone that cleaves to breath from Ilian pipes, shaped to spear the horizon of Atlantic blue, carrageen and crab. Flint and turf furrow skellig spines that once housed the faithful and guillemots. Ribs of curras kneel before Ulysses and crosses, scoured by silent storms, as ancestral skin stretched to beckon retreating tides. Anchored between the sacred and calloused white bone fingers, the Book of Kells lay bleeding.